these sounds because 50 years ago in San Jose, California, there lived a scientist who defined, through his genius, broadcasting. Today, documents, recorded interviews, and witnesses testify that Charles David Herold deserves the title and honor due the founder of modern broadcasting. You in Hong Kong, Alaska, or Johannesburg can tune your radios to a live broadcast from the Paris Opera or to a jazz concert in San Francisco, because a man of vision believed in using the instrument of radio to broadcast to wide audiences. Prof. Herold can be called the Da Vinci of radio. He was a pure scientist who gave his energy, talent, fortune, and all his resources to promote the democratic idea of mass communications through broadcasting. 50 years ago, San Jose code operators were startled to hear not this coming out of their earphones. But this. A flip of your dial now can bring you drama, music, news, and contests. This documentary will introduce to you people who were there when broadcasting was born. These persons have watched it grow from an awkward infant to the big, healthy industry it is today. Adding a page to radio history, the San Jose State College chapter of Sigma Delta Chi, professional journalistic fraternity, uncovered proof of Herold's achievements. Here are recorded for all time the words of those who lived through the eventful and challenging years of Herold's experiments. This is an interview with Mr. Ray Newby at his home, 610 Sharon Avenue, Stockton, California. The date, January 9th, 1959. Your interviewer, Gordon Greb, teacher at San Jose State College. Is this the same Ray Newby who, with Charles D. Herold, successfully broadcast by radio from the Garden City Bank building in San Jose about 1909?
Yes, sir, definitely. I'll never forget it.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was experimental at the time, and it was quite a thrill to everyone. All the crystal detectors in San Jose and for miles around were not only thrilled, but shocked to hear voices coming over when they were really listening to the spark code. Noises, in other words. The voice was a shock to almost anyone that heard it the first time.
How did you actually broadcast?
The first broadcasting was done on the generally experimented with spark method. That's what set Dr. Herold going on this arc system that he developed very shortly afterwards.
This was an improved method?
Oh, my, yes.
Tell us about that method.
Well, he saw the roughness of the spark method used by McCarthy Wireless Telephone Company. They sold stock on it for a while. And he tried to develop a smoother method whereby the carrier wave would be quiet, and all you would hear would be the voice and music and not a lot of static. And I definitely know that his was smooth. There was a very slight hissing noise if you listen for it, but it wasn't obnoxious at all. It was very pure, clean broadcast, and it was received, of course, on crystal detectors, no amplifiers, but all the experimenters within range were happy to hear voices over the air, and it was pure and clear and distinct, and in fact it was it would handle music very nicely. That was when the ARC telephone was put on the air.
How did you get listeners in those days?
Well, they came by experimentation, and we even called up people that we knew were had crystal detectors and would tell them what time we'd be on, and to give us a check, a report, how it came in. Naturally, we're making adjustments on our helix and on our condensers and our telephone. We're trying to improve it at all times.
And this was back around...
The first I remember on the ARC was approximately 1910.
And you'd call people up and say, we're going to do a broadcast, tune us in.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those we knew that had receivers, friends, of course, too.
People located in all directions.
Here and there.
This wasn't point-to-point, necessarily.
Well, not in any great distance. We were just happy to know we were getting out.
What would you do in the way of broadcasting?
We would discuss the news items in the paper, or just a general conversation that might be interesting to anyone so that they could understand, and we'd play records on the phonograph. That was the general method of entertainment then, was to get a phonograph and turn it on, and then they could listen to the music.
Back in the early days, young boys all over San Jose heard music like that on their crystal sets. And one of them was young Joe Capa. He remembers it was 1912, all right, because he nailed his mother's new broom to the top of the barn. And he'll never forget the reception he got for that. Joe Capa soon became acquainted with Doc Harold and his station up in the Garden City Bank building. He remembers the station's operation distinctly.
I went to Prof. Harrell's wireless college when he was out on South First Street. That was directly after the First World War, about late 1919 or early 1920. All Prof. Harrell's equipment ran on 600 volts of direct current, and the only people that had direct current commercial quantities in those days, as far as I could find out, was a streetcar company. And they used to furnish direct current for house lighting, all the lights in series, and in the outlying districts. And Prof, needing it for his transmitter, used to, we had a bamboo pole. The fellas told me that originally they had this bamboo pole that they had a hook on the end of it. They used to reach over and grab the trolley on it and then pull it up, and we'd have power to go on the air with. The transmitter used 600 volts DC and put out 9 kW on the air. And he ran his shop on this, all the motors and everything in the shop was 600 volts. The streetcar company could never figure out why they ran one streetcar a night out South First Street and used 9 kW of juice almost constantly for 2 or 3 hours while Prof was broadcasting. And eventually they got wise to us, and they put in a meter and gave Prof the juice legitimately. They didn't want him to have it originally. The shop there, we had knife switches to start our motors with. We used to throw this knife switch out and get an arc on it and light our cigarettes on it. Nobody ever seemed to have matches around the place. But one night, one of the boys got his nose in the arc and got burned and knocked all over the place. And so Prof very definitely told us to lay off that kind of stuff in the future. The spectacular that you asked me about was the last New Year's Eve before the First World War. During the war, all the stations were dismantled and taken off the air by government order. And on this last New Year's Eve, my brother and I went home to hear the shot that was going to be heard round the world and to see a flare that was supposed to be heard round the world. Prof had quite a bit of advertising in the papers on this. Most of his advertising was word of mouth by the kids in, that were interested in radio. And so my brother and I, when we heard about this, we went home to listen to it, and he used to put on a record and probably a 3 or 4 minute pause, and then another record, and then another 4 or 5 minute pause, and then some speaking. They didn't have the timing that the broadcast stations have now. Of course, we didn't have the audience, and anything we heard was good. So, along about 5 minutes to 12, we heard someone's voice tell us to watch out the window for the flare and listen for the shot. Well, right at midnight, we saw the flare, and we heard a little headphones, and that was the end of it. We didn't hear any more. directly after the war, when I met Prof, I asked him what had happened, and he told me of the hours that he had spent building a carbon transmitter consisting of some six buttons on a single diaphragm, and all interconnected and water-cooled, and a very elaborate affair that he had spent some 400 or 500 work hours constructing. And he had set this up, and it was the first time it had ever been used, and he told Clem Portal was to shoot the pistol that was going to be heard around the world. Well, this was a blank cartridge, 45 caliber army pistol, and Portal put the muzzle of the gun directly in front of the transmitter and pulled the trigger at the right time and blew a hole through the thing. And that was the end of Prof Spectacular.
Ming a toy, long the boy, happy little Japanese. Too long a love is a name, set her a heart aflame. One a day, he say, soon I gotta go away.
Broadcasting programs from the top of the Garden City Bank building in San Jose wasn't enough for Doc Harold. He had other ideas, which Ray Newby describes.
How about remote broadcast? By that I mean doing a broadcast from someplace else in town other than from the top of the Garden City Bank building.
Well, we tried that and had some success, quite some success. It was received in our nearby receiving our the people listening to the say within a reasonable length of time or distance, we were able to pick up over the telephone other programs and put them on through our microphone, and they'd be received at the other receiving stations. One in particular was one sent from the college, State College in San Jose, that we transmitted over the station. I can't remember the name of the play or whatever it was. It was quite popular at that moment or time, and it was quite a thing to remote broadcast. And we made several checks and tests like that.
Was this from Morris Daly Auditorium?
It was
the auditorium on
yes,
the campus.
Yes, the auditorium at the Normal College over in there.
Which is today San Jose State College.
That's right.
And did you have to have success with that?
Yes, it was reported very successful. We had a little difficulty in picking up the full program because of the insensitivity of the microphone. We had to rig up an improvised reflector to collect in some of the audio waves that it had to pick up.
How did you do that?
Used an old chopping ball, a wooden chopping ball, and placed the microphone in the middle of it.
And this caught the voice and reflected it back into
the
mic.
It helped to. We didn't have amplification to amplify the signal. Therefore, we had to pick up all of the strength of the signal we could without wasting it. It's the reverse of a searchlight. We put the microphone in the center of a parabola chopping bowl, and that helped us get more signal.
This was when you had the tube-operated station, though. This wasn't the ARC station, was it?
That's true. That was later on. It was pioneering, more or less, then, too. It was the beginning of remote transmission of many stations later.
One person who knew and admired the great character of Charles David Harold was a young girl whom he took for his wife in 1913. Maiden name, Sybil M. Paul. Now remarried, Mrs. Sybil M. True vividly recalls the day-to-day activities of San Jose's radio pioneer.
Mrs. True, I'd like to talk to you about your late husband, Mr. Charles B. Harold. As a man who was devoted to science, do you think that he was the type of person who would claim credit when it wasn't due to him?
No, he was just the opposite. He never did claim the credit that was really due him. He wanted to always share his honors with someone else. And he was more than fair. I've often thought in the years not too far past that he should have been really given great honor over the things that he has done and completed. He was a perfectionist in his science work. He would work real long hours, day and night, on some things, and if he started on a patent or the invention of something pertaining to his wireless and his radio work, why, it was not complete to him until it was perfect. I might say at this point that Mr. Harrell spent thousands of dollars in the experimental work and actually went through his inheritance, completing and developing the different patents and inventions for his wireless and radio work.
Would you call him a person who was devoted to this, who would get up early in the morning and work all day and then even to the late hours at night?
Yes, he worked very long hours. It was really his life. He did not belong to any lodges, any clubs. He was not interested in gay times or going out for a good time. His enjoyment was in working in his laboratory, in perfecting the things that he had worked on for so many years. To him, there was always room for improvement, and he was constantly striving to do that.
Now, he was interested in many things besides radio, wasn't he? I mean, he was really a genius, wouldn't you say?
Yes, he was.
What were some of the traits that you would say marked him as a genius?
Oh, it was so many things. There wasn't a subject that one could talk on that Mr. Harrell couldn't converse fluently on the subject. He was very brilliant in so many things. The Bible, he could recite it forward and backward. He could tell you, if you would quote any part of the Bible, he'd tell you where you might find it.
I understand that he was consulted many times on difficult mathematical problems.
Yes, he was. He used a slide rule, and they would come to him with difficult problems. And I can see him now take this slide rule out of his side pocket, and in a few minutes he would have the answer and how it was done.
Of course, he was a great teacher, though, because he did found the Harrell College of Engineering.
That's right.
I imagine that he loved to convey this information to the young students of his day.
Yes, and astronomy, you could stand with him out and look up into the heavens, and he could tell you the name of every star, of every planet, the location, where they would be at different seasons of the year. And he was a most interesting person to live with and to talk with.
I understand that he also invented something for streetcars here in San Jose. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, there was a party that wanted to do advertising on the old-time streetcar. You probably remember the advertising that was along the sides, and they were stationary, but the idea was now to get one that would change with the movement of the car. So he invented I have forgotten just what they called it. It did have a name, but it went down around the wheels of the car, and it was a chain effect. And as the wheels went around, it would a little cup would pick up the different little, I guess you'd call them notches, and it would change. This picture on each end of the streetcar would change, and that was an advertising scheme. And about every block, why, this picture or this advertising of some product would change, and it was really a wonderful invention, and worked on at the in the pits of the car barns here in San Jose. He perfected that, and after he perfected it, why, he just simply turned it over to the people that he had started with in the beginning, but as far as making any money out of it, he just didn't have any interest in the money part. It was in something that he had started, and he finished it, and when he finished it, it was perfect.
I understand that you went around the countryside in the early days, helping people build small receiving sets so that he could promote this idea of broadcasting. Do you recall him saying that?
Yes, yes, he did. He would go out and sometimes into the barns and into their garages and help them with their crude little sets, but when he got through, why, they would be able to receive the small programs that we had at that time.
Now, do you remember when you first heard his programs? What were they like?
Well, first it was the voice that they wanted to improve on, and then they began playing records. And at that time, the receiving sets were not like we have today. They were little pieces of galena with a fine little wire that you would turn with a knob, and it would go down, and as it hit the galena, it would pick up the different little hams, as we called it in those days, broadcasting stations. And the at that time, it was the hams that were listening for this voice that was coming over their headphones.
And would you say that he was broadcasting voice and music when you knew him back in 1913?
Oh, yes.
In 1913?
In fact, I talked to the operators myself in August of 1914, no, in September, September the 5th, 1914, our first baby boy was born. And when he was about, oh, I judge now, I have forgotten, it's been so many years ago, I think he was 4 or 5 months old, and we have a picture of him where I'm holding up to him up to the transmitter, and he was just crying as hard as he could cry. But that was the thing we wanted to see, if that baby's cry could be transmitted to the Fairmont Hotel.
This was Robert R. True.
This was Robert Roy True, which was Robert Roy Harold at that time.
Mm-hmm. First baby probably to ever cry over the radio.
To ever cry over the radio. Well, in that time it was wireless. And I really believe that I was the first woman to ever broadcast a program. And I went to Sherman Clay and arranged to borrow records from them at no cost, but just for the sake of advertising the records to these young operators with their little galena sets, and we would play the up-to-date young people's records, you know, and they would run down the next day and be sure to buy that one they heard on the radio the night before.
The music and voices which Doc Harold put on the air back in 1909 established the world's first regular broadcasting station. And by the year 1915, Harold's station was broadcasting a daily schedule of programs to the San Francisco World's Fair. A man who remembers these broadcasts and who testifies in Harold's behalf is a radio pioneer in his own right, Dr. Lee DeForest. This is his tribute to Harold's accomplishment.
Dr. DeForest, as I understand it, what you're saying is that the Harold station in San Jose, by transmitting music and voice regularly to your booth at the Panama Pacific Exposition in 1915, certainly qualifies it to be honored as the world's oldest broadcasting station today.
Yes, considering that it's still in operation.
Would you like to congratulate the station?
I want to congratulate that station on being the pioneer, first in the spark, then with the arc, then with the oscillating tube, and still maintaining the service from 1909 to the present time, over 50 years. That's a record to be proud of.
50 years of broadcasting, 1909 to 1959. make this the golden anniversary of broadcasting for the radio and television industry. First to broadcast on a regular schedule, first to build and create his own audiences, first to recognize the boundless horizon of radio as a communications medium. We honor Charles David Herold today and this year, truly the founder of modern broadcasting, because of voices and music which filled the air back in the good old days of 1909. This has been the story of broadcasting, written and directed by Anthony Taravella, with production assistance from Robert Conger. All interviews on this program were tape-recorded conversations with the actual witnesses of Herold's achievements, gathered during research into the origin of broadcasting by your narrator, Gordon Greb, assistant professor of journalism. This has been a San Jose State College production. Thank you.